Okay, folks, this is Parasitology Seminar, September 4th, 2008, and the big news today is that Coca-Cola's bought Inca-Cola, and certain tourists will never buy Inca-Cola t-shirts in the Lima Airport again.
This is not purchased in the Lima Airport, this is purchased in...
Off in the woods somewhere?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Today I'm going to talk about some stuff I've been thinking about for quite a while. And I'll also, is it this one here?
Yeah, okay. Red button.
Maybe I'll just come up here and talk and see if all this works. For a variety of reasons, over the last year, the subject of the effects of parasites on various kinds of organisms, particularly their evolutionary histories, has come up over and over and over again in groups other than among the parasitologists. And as a result of going through, you know, maybe 25,000 abstracts en route to finishing up the textbook revision, I've come across a lot of this commentary in the literature by people who are not necessarily fully acquainted with parasitism in its broadest perspective, drawing conclusions or at least proposing associations between infectious agents of various kinds and evolutionary trajectories, fitness, and what have you. So this has kind of been on my mind, and some of you last year, I think, had access to the parasitology primer, or the parasitology, the parasit primer, I think we call it, the 10 rules, and those rules were also sort of an outgrowth of encountering all of this literature. And then finally, of course, we got the notice asking for RUTE mentors, and I volunteered and submitted a proposal. We don't have any idea whether that's going to be funded yet or not, or whether I'll get selected as one of those mentors. But the proposal... Pardon me?
What's RUTE?
The acronym, what's it stand for?
Research for Undergraduates in Theoretical Ecology. Yeah. And so that proposal was really based on... some work that students have done over the years, class project work regarding parasites in damselflies, and especially the work that Krista Major and Brian Shockley did this summer on egg masses and Gregorian parasite masses and mite numbers and all of that stuff, trying to determine whether there was an association between parasitism and investment in, particularly in eggs, in females of damselflies, simply because they were pretty good and accessible hosts to use. So I've just been thinking about this. So what I'm going to do today is tell you not so much any kind of conclusions, but just how the thinking is going. And this is really not so much about parasites, but necessarily about how to think about parasites and how one person might be thinking about parasites in the realm of this literature. Now, if you go into BioAbstracts and just simply do a keyword search on Ischneria verticalis, which is what these damselflies are, then you'll come up with a lot of information, a great deal of information, in fact, on nutrition and behavior in the presence of supposedly selective forces like predation from dragonfly naiads, dragonfly larvae, and fish, and what have you. So the story you read about very often in freshman textbooks then is the response of prey to the presence of predators, and how the prey responds by either changing body, you know, adapting physiologically or adapting genetically or phenotypically. And there's a fair amount of that in the Ischneria verticalis literature. Also, it's one that we've studied for years and years and years, and it's easy to recognize.
The other one.
Hmm?
need the other one to actually make it go.
And there are...
There you go. But I need to know what 090408 is.
That is September 4th, 2008.
Okay.
And as an aside, this month's... Yeah, I'll just give you a little bit of an aside. I think I can get finished with this without much trouble before 1 o'clock. As a little bit of an aside, this latest edition, latest issue of Scientific American... is all devoted to electronic security and the loss of privacy. And as a result of course, university policies on use of clicker numbers and student IDs as code numbers to post grades, I asked my 101 class this semester to make up a 6-character code name that I could use to post grades. And probably half of them wrote their birthday in this format. And I just thought that was amazing. So, okay, forward.
So with the month first and the day second.
Yeah, and we use that format because, and we put it in as text in spreadsheets because you can sort real easily that way. And you can sort by day and there's never any difference. I mean, there's never any duplication. Okay, I'm going to start with my personal opinion about the default associations that non-parasitologists have about parasites. They hurt you and make you sick. Your potential mates are turned off by them. There's some stuff in relative to mice and how they smell if they're infected with tapeworms and what have you. If you have them, you can't rear as many babies as you could if you didn't have them. So there's quite a bit of literature on these first three assertions. And this stuff right here comes from, not necessarily from the primary literature, but from academic politics. And this stuff comes really from academic politics. But not only that, but if you go back to Gilbert Castro's presidential address to the American Society of Parasitologists back in, when was it, the late 80s, 1987, 1986, something like that. Whatever year we had the meetings at Wake Forest, the title of his presidential address was "The Pariahs of the Scientific World," something to that effect. And he was talking about other people's opinions of those who studied parasites in the gut. And it was, so it's worth going back and talking about that. But this is all 50 years of academic politics. This one, I think, the first one, which I led with, that non-parasitologists assume that parasitologists are never really studying the correct questions. This I've just heard over and over and over again. And these are pretty kind of self-explanatory. Actually, the idea that parasitologists study things that are dirty and they get dirty themselves, this comes out of, in many ways, the opening remarks of Everett Schiller when he gave his Henry Baldwin Ward acceptance speech and described his first encounter with the world of parasitism. However, many parasitologists feel that the non-parasitologist default assumptions about parasitism are really pretty dumb.
Can I hear one of your default assertions, just one?
It's an assertion that you make without really thinking anything through. It's a reflex.
Oh, okay.
Okay? We could make some default assumptions about current political candidates.
I was just going there.
Okay. Okay. So here's sort of a Venn diagram visual representation of the last couple of slides. But ideally, what we would really like to do, if we're good educators and good scientists, is kind of make all of these realms congruent and pull them together, so that the default assumptions about parasites are really those that the parasitologist would make. And to explain this, really to clarify it a little bit, here's another version of the Venn diagram. All of the free-living organisms are included within this realm of parasites, of course, because every free-living organism that's been studied extensively has been shown to have at least one and usually several species of of parasites. So if we think of a space, a sort of a philosophical space called an organism idea space, that includes not only the organisms themselves, but also all of the thoughts and work and ideas about them as a kind of a various domains of reality space that include thoughts, ideas, theories, as well as the organisms themselves. A parasitologist's assertions really maybe don't necessarily about what parasites do. It's not necessarily completely congruent with that of the parasites themselves, because we don't know a lot of stuff about some of this. So that's the space here. And by and large, this is a pretty good representation, I think, even based on the literature, of the extent to which our assertions about parasitism and its effect on free-living organisms overlap those with some of the other groups. So the rather obvious device then for making those domains congruent is, as we might suspect, careful examination of the life of Ischnura verticalis. Now, if in any other organism that we had, that we knew enough about and was convenient, could get a lot of pretty pictures about, would suffice here. Keep in mind the credits are all the previous cited sources. So we're going to talk about the life of Ischnura verticalis with kind of a special focus on the role of parasites in terms of reproductive success. And here's our female, of course, choosing some males. And this is our assumption that females choose males, but that may not be a good assumption after all. Males could easily go chase females and grab them. But what we have here, I put some mites on there, and so this one has a lot of mites, this one has fewer, this one has been many. So the question that might, sort of the paradigm of behavioral ecology, evolutionary ecology, evolutionary behavior might well be, given this picture, which is really a very simple kind of a picture, there would be some impact of those red dots on this choice. And the answer and the reality is there's probably no impact whatsoever. So because these kinds of systems are really exceedingly complex, I'll get into that complexity here in a second, and because they are fairly difficult to study in nature, even the easiest of them, I think we need to start thinking about models. So here's half of the life of Ischnura verticalis, from egg through growth of the larva to emergent, where it crawls out on a piece of aquatic vegetation and starts to metamorphose into what's called a tenaril. So whatever model you build that might address the question, what effect does parasitism have on the reproductive success, the Darwinian fitness of this creature, would really have to take into account all of these events and all of these stages. Which means then that you need to talk a little bit about the risk factors that are involved. And so I've listed a few of the fairly obvious ones, the date that the eggs are laid, you know, whether those eggs are produced in, are actually deposited in early in the warm season or late, the nature of the pond the eggs are laid in, nature of the vegetation in that pond. These two, B and C, then, are, and I've lettered these for later reference. B and C are really fairly closely related. Runoff from the land surrounding the pond. There's a fair amount of literature, and some of it by a fairly famous ecologist named Hairston, that talks about the nutrient, the nutritional changes that occur in ponds with certain kinds of natural runoffs from various environments, such things as leaf litter and dead vegetation of various kinds. So this runoff from the land surrounding the pond, well, it could be toxic, of course, in an agricultural setting, but it also is related somewhat to the microinvertebrate community. In the microinvertebrate community, going all the way down to the protists, is really the prey items for our damselfly naiads. There's also a diversity of fish and larger insect larvae and larger adult insects, actually, that are capable of feeding on these larval ones. And then there are, of course, these parasites, which the three main groups are mites, water mites, gregarins, and trematode larvae, most notably frog lung flukes and bladder flukes that end up inside the hemocoel of damselfly, and then combinations of all of the above. So these things are produce enough complexity in and of themselves, but when you start taking them in combinations, then you can take them in combinations of 2, 3, 4, whatever whatever you want. And so suddenly the number of factors that might have to be entered into or programmed into a model is very large. And so just beginning with a fairly simple version, straight out of sort of high school math, might be look something like this. So the probability the larval damselfly will reach the tenarel stage. That tenarel stage is the stage, of course, that crawls out on the grass and has just metamorphosed. This probability is some function of all of these things. And I've combined B and C, and the nature of the pond, and the nature of the vegetation, because they're pretty easily to combine. And each of these acts sort of independently. And so I've multiplied them together. And it really, remember, it only applies to a single pond in a single location and over a single breeding season. So this probability of achieving tenarel stage can be pretty low. What I've also done is pull some probability functions out of the literature, three really simple common ones, and I've just made up these curves, but this is exactly the kind of probability function you might come up with if you actually did work on any kind of a simple little thing like throwing marbles into a bunch of cans or something like that, and rearrange your cans and introduce different kinds of characteristic of throwing the marbles into cans. You come up with these with a bunch of different frequency distribution type things. So, it's entirely possible that your probability curves for different ponds each look different. In fact, that's exactly what you would expect. But once you actually derive for any single pond a probability function for achieving the tenarel stage, then this last combination one comes into play, and this function then will be some version of the multiple kind lottery, my hope in my lifetime is to live long enough to see this multiple kind lottery model actually brought to a serious fruition. And we've published on it a number of times, including the code. But it's, in my view, there's some real philosophy involved here that needs to be elaborated upon, and I hope eventually to get that done successfully. Multiple kind lottery means, for example, if you have a choice, 5 or 6 items, and you're going to end up with 2, then your choices, then the 2 you end up with, it can both be considered successes, but they could be 1 and 5, 3 and 5, 2 and 4, this sort of thing. And each one of those combinations then has its own unique probability, usually. And then the null model is that whatever factors are involved in getting those various numbers of successes are totally random. So this is our tenarel stage, and now we get to the life of the adult, and our tenarel is now going to harden up and go out and seek a mate. And I put mate selection inside a big black box because this is, if you actually went out and tried to study this stuff in nature, you would discover that there's a whole lot of stuff going on that influences that almost on a day-to-day and minute-to-minute basis, including wind and the amount of daily temperature fluctuations. It just goes on and on. So at any rate, there's a whole set of these things that are involved. And again, the same kind of set of circumstances really influences the adult stages too, although in a totally different environmental setting, including the date of emergence and all of this. I forgot to put a red arrow in there. I'm sorry. So again, the probability that a tenoral will lay eggs is really, again, it's almost exactly the same kind of probability function. And once you get that calculated, then the next step becomes applying the multiple kind of lottery model. So what we have is really, and again, the same set of probability functions and probability distributions can apply to the adults as well as to the larva. And then, of course, there is some link between the adults and the larva that I haven't even talked about and I'm not going to. So some of you may have seen this one before. This is actually derived from a show about college students. And the original titles here were something like Entering College, Get Your General Studies Out of the Way, Take the Good Stuff for Your Major, Get an Excellent Job, Write a Big Check to the Alumni Association or the Foundation or something like, you know, and live happily ever after. No ornery kids, no divorces, no debt, you know, all that kind of stuff. Live happily ever after. However, this kind of a diagram is also fairly typical of textbooks and a lot of literature in which our ideas about how organisms live are laid out in kind of either a circular or a linear fashion. And I put the parasites in here just for the heck of it. The real situation, however, looks much more like this, and this is also out of the student talk in which all these eggs were students and all these squares were really opportunities, and the interaction between them all was just sort of unpredictable, and it happens every single solitary day. But this can also, these could be damselfly eggs, and your possible outcomes could be anything from mating successfully to getting eaten by a swallow or what have you. And all of these arrows then are all the interactions that we talked about, all the list of kind of stuff. And our poor parasite is here in the middle and doesn't really know what its role is. So what's the best way to approach this problem? Keep it simple, stupid. Is a little phrase that I learned in the Army, of course, and most of you know it, and the acronym for this is KISS. Incidentally, in preparing this slide, I thought, okay, I'm going to talk about KISS, keep it simple, stupid. So what I really need is a picture of a great big lip imprint picture. So I did Google, I said lipstick imprint, and the first thing that came up was a site from Meadowood Elementary PTA. And I thought, what the hell is that doing? So, at any rate, I thought I'd just, out of deference and not knowing who would show up, I kept this simple. So, keep it simple, stupid, which is... So, I actually made I don't have the code. In fact, it's on my home computer. But I made a little program, and it's really in asking about what happens to the probability of laying an egg, or what happens to the probability of metamorphosis into a tenoral if you set up. If you actually don't necessarily model all of those causative factors, but summarize them in really simple little probability equations, and then start calculating probabilities over a whole range of values, and this is really easy to do. I mean, it's just super dumb and simple, and it looks something like this. probability of this thing dying by predation is probably the highest of any of the other risk factors, because normally ponds or environments where this host lives are inhabited by all other kinds of stuff, including predatory fish. So the probability of survival in the first stage is really the 1 minus the probability of the death by predation. Okay, and then I just took another black box and calculated the probability of death by all other causes. And I can't necessarily think of what all those other causes might really be. Starvation, or some student coming along with a dip net, or the pond dries. I don't know what it is. But this risk from all other causes is pretty small compared to this risk. I think that's your intuitive assumption. So this probability, your second stage of probability of surviving, is really this first probability. It's actually 1 minus that. And so you get really to the probability of successfully metamorphosing. And this is, this is just too simple. And so, before I actually show you a graph, I thought I'd talk a little bit about doable studies. What can you actually do with this particular kind of a system? And here's one of them. Here's one good example of a potential project that would be fairly difficult. This is about a 2-year project in which you would spend maybe from the 1st of May through the middle of September at a place like Cedar Point, or set up a little lab out in Nichols Barn or something like that. So what you really need to do this is a lab about like this one, and plenty of baby food jars and lots of pond water. And so at any rate, let's see, we might ask, what's the effect of one kind of parasites on the success of metamorphosis? And I've had a couple of graduate students who've done a little bit of this stuff, aerosefting among them. But one of the things is you really have to deal with concurrent treatment groups. So you can't do part of this work and then first, and then a second part, and second part, and second part. You really have to do repeat experiments with all your treatment groups sort of concurrently. And your organisms need to be in individual containers, and you need to feed them parasite-free prey. So what would you do to actually start on this stuff in the lab? First thing you would do is go out and collect about 1,000 naiads, or larvae, of Ischneria verticalis. And in the best of all worlds, you collect them when they're about second or third instar, because they're not going to be very heavily infected. And you keep them alive then for 3 full months, which means that you have to feed them probably every hour something that is parasite-free, 24 hours a day, that is parasite-free. So you hire some students, but you have to feed them something about every hour that's parasite-free and that's small enough for them to get in their mouths and yet large enough for them to actually see, because they're these visual predators. And so second instar larvae would be about 4 millimeters long. And so you're talking large protozoans or tiny little worms of some kind. And so you have to, not only you have your experimental animals here, but you also have your food animals, your prey menagerie. And as they grow older, then and finally when they get up to about their last larval instar, they will eat ostracods and daphnia. So you have these big colonies of parasite-free daphnia and ostracods, microcrustaceans. And again, you're feeding them about every hour, every couple hours, just to keep them good and healthy. And you're changing their water. and you're making sure that they're in an atmosphere where there's plenty of oxygen. And so you start with 1,000 of these baby food jars because you know you're going to lose at best about half of them. And what you end up with then out of that group is the oocysts to actually infect some of those are really very easy to get. Not necessarily to get in terms of ones that you actually know what the parasite species is, but in general, Gregorian oocysts you can get by the tens of thousands pretty easily. And you can kind of keep those aside in the fridge and build up your supplies. So you could, in fact, have your group that you set aside to experimentally infect very, very heavily. And you assume then that all of those are heavily infected. And you can use a paired T statistical design, which is what Aris did. And this is a fairly powerful and yet fairly simple kind of a design, so that when your damselflies get their wing, when your larvae actually get their wings, and you can see them on there, then you just put that baby food jar with a little stick in it inside a screen cage in pairs, and one of them are the uninfected, and the other ones are the ones you've infected, and then you do your you count the successful emergence. And not only do you count your successful emergence, and probably you have to have a third member of this paired T, which is one that you kill right away just to see if you've successfully infected the thing. So at best, in the most doable part of this study, there are enormous difficulties. And you can make up a very simple program, and then here's actually all I did. What was it, death by predation? I actually increased this probability by started out with 1 in 100. So I'm gonna do this, run this about 100 times. So every time we'll ask, we'll increase this risk a little bit, just to see what happens. And death by all other causes, and I added, I started out with maybe 1 in 1,000 is the probability of dying from anything other than predation. And the parasite effect I also kind of started with 1 in 1,000. And this is what this curve looks like. Iterations of increased probability of death. And the brutal truth is, in this really, really simple kind of a system, in which all of these multiply complex interactions and causalities are all sort of assumed to be constant, except for the effects of parasites, you can, in fact, make that parasite effect change over 2 orders of magnitude, and it has absolutely no effect on this system whatsoever, absolutely none. So this is the kind of place that a person would begin to construct a little bit of a model of this kind of thing. And the whole idea then, as some of you remember from our trematode life cycle model, the whole idea is to set up a set of reasonable assumptions, convert those into code, convert those into equations, and then allow parameter values to be put in, and then change the value of those input parameters over a couple of orders of magnitude and see what happens. So this is really about the summary of the whole thing, I would say. And I think that I really didn't have time to put in another slide. Oh. No, those are just all my damselfly drawings. I'm through. Anybody have any questions?
So, when a damselfly is infected with Gregorians, do you find some that are really hyper-infected, that obviously the Gregorian does have an effect? Or do you always see just kind of a standard?
No, it varies enormously from year to year and pond to pond. And I didn't have Google Earth on my computer at home, so I was going to go ahead and put some of that Google Earth stuff in. For example, when Sarah Richardson was working out at Cedar Point, at a Martin Bay Pond that actually had water in it, her counts were 300 and 400 large gregarians per damselfly, and they were out there breeding like crazy and mating and everything else. To the point that you opened them up and you thought, wow, it looks to me like their gut is just blocked. But you couldn't tell. You know, it wasn't the weak ones who were down there, you know, kind of halfway like this. They were out there. It was all of them flying around. And yet other times they'll be, you know, far less. In fact,
do you think there's a way to measure the respiration of one of those things and see if it makes a difference?
Probably.
Has anybody tried?
Not that I know of. The mice stuff is a little more convincing over an ecological time scale because, you know, they put that stylosome right into the hemocoel and actually drain fluids. And so they're like ticks or black flies or mosquitoes or something like that. I think the only times that parasites seem to have a kind of a major effect on hosts that I can tell is when they suck blood,
yeah,
or the equivalent.
Massive numbers.
Yeah, so hookworm, big hookworm, hemonchus, you know, this kind of stuff. The cymicid bugs, Osiacus vicarius on cliff swallows. I mean, that's kind of the classic study in which those colonies that are infested, fledgling weight is half that of the others and stuff. But then the question becomes, does it really make any difference in the life of the species that this parasitic burden occurs?
Mm-hmm.
And I think you'd have to argue long and hard and far more skillfully than has been done so far to make that case. Simply because when you start looking at cliff swallow reproductive success, the habitat for them to build their houses on has to be number one. And to my knowledge, for a bird that eats insects, they have never learned to just take their bill and go peck, 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 and eat stuff.
Yeah.
It's just stupid.
One of them would learn. But if they did, but if there's no reason to learn, if all the other populations...
Yeah.
It doesn't make a difference if one does learn and it doesn't have a higher reproductive success than the others, then it will go on anyway.
And maybe bed bugs taste bad.
Yeah. Right.